and welcome to On Repeat with me, Beth.
And me, Susanna.
This is the frank and honest podcast about living with obsessive compulsive disorder.
Disclaimer, we are not mental health professionals. Please visit OCD Action and OCD UK for services that can help and support you.
Do, 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 bong, bong, bong.
Can we just let Jack do the music? This week, we are very excited to share with you our chat with the brilliant Bryony Gordon.
I do think running is, for me, exercise growing up was always about punishing yourself, and it was about the losses and not the gains. And for me, running, exercising for my head rather than and my heart, rather than for the way it makes me look,
yeah,
has completely revolutionised the way. Like, I don't do it to be the fastest or the strongest. I do it to be happy.
Bryony is a journalist, best-selling author, and host of her own podcast, Mad World. I first heard her on a podcast, Fern Cotton's Happy Place podcast.
Great podcast.
It's just brilliant, and she speaks so openly, but also with the classic Bryony Gordon charm and wit about having OCD. And it was maybe the first time I'd heard someone chat about it in that kind of way. So it made me, it inspired me to become more open myself about having OCD.
And I've been trying to get Beth to do a podcast for a little while. And I think it was then hearing Bryony on a podcast,
being so frank and honest and also funny,
that made Beth be like, okay, I want to do it.
Yeah, because it kind of, it's just listening to other people speak about it, that it doesn't normalise it, that's not the right word, but it makes you feel, I mean, the whole thing about Bryony's own podcast, Mad World, is kind of making you realise how feeling weird is actually the most normal thing.
And I think it just helps hearing someone who's in the public eye, who has such an, like, publicly successful career.
Yes.
Talking about, like, when George Ezra talked on a podcast.
Yes. Sadly not ours.
Not ours.
Working on that one.
Ellis James and John Robbins, their podcast, about OCD and the fact that he has it. And And I think, you know, I think that would have been helpful for a lot of people because...
Yeah, it definitely makes you feel a bit safer, maybe, in speaking about it yourself, maybe even if it's just to one friend or lots of friends.
Yeah, because it then makes people who are, like, their fans think twice about it because they're like, oh, the person I really admire has it.
Yes.
So you can have it and I don't need to think it's weird or teasing for it because this person has it.
Yeah, right. I think it is going back to that classic thing of kind of everyone has these different things and we all feel, well, it's a human experience and you might feel weird, but if you actually hear other people talking about their own weirdness, you realise you're not that weird or that we're all weird.
Yeah.
How many times can I say the word weird? Little warning, there is some fruity language.
Woohoo!
Woo! So this might be one for the headphones. Our conversation in this episode was recorded back in the second lockdown. So it was recorded in November. So we do have a little bit of lockdown chat with Bryony at the beginning. And actually that is still pretty relevant as we are in lockdown number 3. So hopefully some of that might be quite useful right now. But also we wanted to release it this week as it coincides with the release of Bryony's latest book, No Such Thing as Normal. A perfect addition to your lockdown reading list. And I promise the whole episode isn't just about lockdown. If you're anything like me, you need a little bit of escapism from that subject as well. But just quickly, I wanted to mention that OCD Action is still running all the way through lockdown. Their helplines, support groups and forums remain open. So you can visit their website for more information and support. So that's at ocdaction.org.uk.
I've done some, like, when it came to recording the season of Mad World lockdown, there were times when I was like, I'm going to have to go to, I'm going to have to, like, deliver a tin can and some string. And you've got, like, I had, like, Daisy May Cooper. I'm so sorry, this isn't working.
But she strikes me as the kind of person that would literally not care at all.
No, she didn't give a shit. But it was like, it is that thing of, like, I felt this kind of real codependent sense when, like, because you're asking people to do, because at the time it was like this stuff that people had no kind of awareness of. Let me do one thing. I need to open a window because it's like being on the surface of the sun in my room today.
It's angelic.
The sun is like directly on the window and my legs are like on fire. One second. I'm probably getting too cold now. But, okay, so.
So, Susanna, you wanted to start with a very important question.
Yeah, just the very important question of how are you right now?
In lockdown.
Yeah, it's lockdown again. Like, how are you doing?
I'm actually fine. Yeah, I mean, I find this one much easier. This
yes.
one. I find it weird. I've always kind of maintained that actually lockdown in the winter would weirdly be easier than the summer.
Me too.
I don't know about you. Yeah. But the summer, like, I just wanted to be out. I wanted to, like, go for the day to the beach. Mm-hmm. I wanted to... You know, and I wanted to be outside, whereas now I just want to be locked. I just, not locked, but now I want to be kind of snuggled inside. Like last night, it was like blowing a gale and the rain was hammering against the windows. And I just thought, I don't have no interest in being anywhere other than home. I mean, I go out in the morning and I go for like a walk or a run or something. But it's not, and it's not as kind of stringent as the last one, is it? And I definitely get that feeling. It's funny because lockdowns, they sort of... They remind me a bit of like depressive or OCD episodes. Mm-hmm. It's that thing of being trapped inside and in your own head. And I kind of feel that you have to approach them. I've had to approach it almost in the same way because otherwise, I know that, like, I talk about my OCD as I call it Jareth the Goblin King, which is like, you're probably too young to have watched Labyrinth. It was a film when I was a kid and David Bowie played Jareth the Goblin King. Evil and ever so slightly enticing. So I write about this in my book, Mad Girl.
Yeah.
And Jareth, as I call him, loves to tell me. Jareth has a very similar voice to mine, In fact, it's unrecognised, indistinguishable sometimes. And Jareth loves to tell me that I like to be alone. And I don't want to go outside. So when lockdown happened, I was like, yay, I don't have to socialise with anyone. I don't have to, like, do any of the... I can be by myself, state-sanctioned isolation.
Yeah.
Bring it on. But, of course, that's very dangerous because that isn't... That's my kind of mental illness speaking.
Mm.
Not me. And I need to recognise it for when it is. Mm-hmm. So I've had to be very careful that I haven't kind of... gone into myself, and I found that, like, my OCD can really catch me out. It's quite clever. Like, I have a type called Pure O, and when I was a child, it told me, I was a serial killing paedophile or whatever. But because I don't get that anymore, I don't get that, I don't have those kind of thoughts. I can often think that I've kind of, like,
conquered it.
It'll come back in other ways. Like, I can think, whatever the big issue of the day is, worry that I have,
totally get it.
Onto coronavirus, and am I the worst person in the world because I've gone outside without a mask on? So I have to. It kind of will. It's very clever.
Like, it's so clever. It's sneaky. Someone described it recently as whack-a-mole. So it's like when you've whacked it down in that area, like the paedophile one, then up it pops in another place and you don't realise it's even OCD sometimes, that it's kind of getting you.
And I think I've had to, like, the best thing that I can do is just go, well, maybe, is it the worst, if you did happen to have spread coronavirus to the, this is life, I have to sort of let the thoughts come in and not be so, and accept them and accept that,
it's thoughts, so hard.
But the thoughts don't make me me.
No.
And I think they are, the thing about OCD is I've realised, like, I did, because I'm 40 now, it's really interesting talking to, young people, Susanna, you're 23, and you were saying before we start, that you, for you, going to, you've grown up in a much more accepting culture of mental health, and it's something that you could talk about. But when I was 23, I didn't talk about it. Do you know what I mean? I mean, it's nearly 20 years ago, Christ. but like, it's taken me a long, long time to get to this stage. Like, the interesting thing is now, so over the years, I would quietly try and get help for, I knew I had a type of OCD, but I had no idea of where to get help for it. And I'd go and do things like CBT and, you know, and I remember going on a course, some intensive OCD course once, where I had to like walk a banana down the street. It was very strange.
I read this in your book.
Wait, what? Walk a banana? What?
It's still offered on, I think, you know, you can go online, but it was sort of to try and expose you to do things to get out of your comfort zone.
Oh, right, okay.
But it was quite difficult. It was very kind of like, it was quite difficult. But so CBT not only stands for cognitive behavioral therapy, but also for something like, well, it's the motorbike test.
Oh, yes, it is, isn't it? Yeah, it is.
Yeah, yeah. And I remember I called up, I just in desperation called CBT, and it was like, this thing came up in like Vauxhall, which was near where I lived. And I was like, can I help? And they were like, well, we can book you in for, and then I realised I'd booked myself in for a provisional driving test.
Oh my God.
But the thing that has really helped me with my OCD more than anything else is actually just the time and the knowledge of what it is. And the, you know, and the, but it's also, for me, has been the thing that has, I was always really resistant to kind of like going back over my childhood, or because I was like, I grew up in a nice house in like Chiswick, and we had an Arga and a cat with Moppet, and nothing bad ever happened to me, right? And I was like, we can skip this bit. But actually, going over what I, because you don't have to have had like a monstrous childhood develop, for your brain to develop weird coping mechanisms. And I now see that OCD, like so many other mental illnesses, was my brain's way of trying to protect me. Mm-hmm. But it just sort of slightly
did it wrong. Yeah.
Gets it wrong. So it misfires. So it's my way, it was my brain's way of trying to keep me safe when I didn't feel safe. And that is such a helpful bit of context and perspective to have now, because when I feel it cracking up, you know, on there are other ways in which I'm like, okay, Bryony, just kind of sit. You know, this is what happens to you when you are feeling stressed, when stressful things are going on in your life. And so it makes sense.
Yeah.
So this is a long-winded way to get, you know, that this kind of stuff would come up when lockdown happened. And I, like, actually, weirdly, because the first way that OCD manifested itself for me, when I was 12, there was a big public health campaign about AIDS, right?
Yeah.
And there were these adverts that were quite frightening, and there was like tombstones would fall and it would go, don't die of ignorance. And
it was
a very sort of like home, you know, it was a different time, you know. There was a lot of fear and panic and homophobia and lots of different things. And I became convinced when I was 12 that I had AIDS, right, which was like, And I've since discovered that this is among people my age, this is such a common
really
OCD.
That's
so common,
interesting,
because it was the big public hysteria of the day.
Right?
And then, but so I was obsessed with washing my hands, so the germ thing really came into play, and I couldn't leave I was 12, 13, and I just couldn't leave the house. I had to like hide my toothbrush under my pillow. I had no vocabulary at all for OCD. I had no idea what it was.
Yeah.
It's like I just thought I was dying.
Mm.
And of course, now I know what it is. But of course, so when it was really interesting to me that when you have a global pandemic announced and sweeping the, you know, the world, as that's what pandemics are. I remember someone saying to me, are you okay? Like back in February when it was all brewing, you're worried about this. And I, it's so weird. Like, I think because when you've actually lived in that state of high anxiety and adrenaline over stuff, when these things actually really happen in real life, I just didn't faze me at all.
That's what you were like, isn't it? Yeah. Susanna was the same.
People were like, this is so weird.
Yeah.
But my mum was like, I can't believe it. When you were just, you couldn't leave the house. You were so scared
of
germs.
Yeah.
Because I have, like, a lot of my stuff is contamination OCD. And I have a phobia of sick in like normal life. So my biggest fear is being sick. And that's where all my OCD kind of comes back down to. And it was really weird for me when the pandemic started and all these things that like all the like the government being like, you need to wash your hands, you need to keep your distance from people, all these things that I just kind of been inherently doing over my life, which I've been like, other people need to do as well, because otherwise, as soon as everyone else was doing them, I was like, I don't like this.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I was like, I don't like everyone else doing it because now the world's not normal and I miss the normal life. And also, it's weird that I've now got friends who are like, quite nervous to go out or do things, or like really like, oh, I need to clean my hands. And I'm less like it. And I think it's because that isn't my fear. My fear is being sick. So I'm not scared of this horrific thing, which
shows
is,
how illogical OCD can be.
I also think that there's a sense of like, when you have OCD, you are very alone, right, in your own head. And as with all mental illnesses, and of course, there's an element of isolation due to the lockdown, but there's also the knowledge that everyone's going through it at the same time. So it's much less isolating in that respect.
Yeah,
so
I don't think it's
not a sense of like, you know, it doesn't sort of it doesn't get to you in that way, I don't think. And, you know, it's, and I also think that one of the things I've realised, and I've done a whole kind of book on this actually, which is coming out in January, called No Such Thing as Normal. And it came from this realization at the beginning of lockdown that all of the people I knew who had experienced mental health crisis of some form were fine. They were like, okay, we'll deal with this. Like, we have to go inside for a few weeks. And, you know, like, it is what it is. There's nothing we can do. To be honest, being locked down in your home while was like a walk in the park compared to being locked inside your very own head with depression. And I realised that so many of the things that I had thought were kind of flaws and failures of myself were actually like superpowers.
Yeah.
Now, of course, one cannot take away from the fact that the longer this goes on, lockdowns have been the cause of mental health issues in itself. Right?
Yeah.
So I don't want to say, oh, lockdowns are a walk in the park for everyone.
No.
But what I'm saying is that if you had prior experience of it, it's, you know, it is like, there is a kind of like, right, you can, I can do this.
Compared to living with your mental illness, lockdown is kind of a, it's a breeze.
What's been interesting for me, and I'm sure other people relate to this, is that I think I cope with anxiety and OCD through distraction a lot of the time. So I'll have a really busy, always trying to like be doing something. So for me, when the first lockdown happened, and it was it felt a bit out of the blue, my OCD actually kind of ramped up because it was like suddenly I didn't have the ability to see people, chat to people, go out, blah, 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 blah. And also I found that I've learned a lot. I'm sure everyone has learned a lot about themselves during these times, because I've realized how much of my anxiety is fueled by my phone, like having WhatsApp and just the only way that you could communicate with friends being through your phone. I found for some reason became a bit of like almost a compulsion, like the checking the phone, it was weird to me that, similar to you though, like it wasn't about coronavirus, it was about other stuff in my life. And it made me think about how with OCD and anxiety, it's always about stuff that might happen or that you could have done in the past. It's all about something that you don't know for sure. Whereas we knew that coronavirus was a thing. So like you couldn't worry about it in the same way because you already knew it was here.
It was already happening. You couldn't.
If that makes sense.
It does. I think it's weird. And I think there's a sort of weird survival instinct that kicks in as well.
Yeah, 100%.
When they're actually real and presented to you.
Yeah.
But I do think it is. It's all very bad for mental health in terms of the isolation and in terms of what it can, you know, the potential it has to push you back into bad, not bad, but you know, unhealthy.
Yeah.
And takes away, like for me, as well as OCD, I'm one of my chief coping mechanisms for dealing with OCD, because when I was a girl, there was nothing out there, no awareness, was alcohol and drugs. So I'm in recovery from alcoholism and drug addiction. And the go-to meetings, and those went away. And of course, you have them online, but it's not quite the same. But so, like, bit by bit, the kind of lack of all those little kind of healthy coping mechanisms that you put in that are taken away.
Yeah.
You know, start to go, and I think it's okay for a small period of time, but when you're now into, what are we, like, month? I mean, I was going to say with no end in sight, but there is now. But, yeah. You know, but I feel quite sort of pragmatic about it all.
Yeah.
I'm more concerned about, like, for me, is, like, the state of like, mental health services. They were pretty parlous before the pandemic.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's all sorts of things now that mean, you know, really severely mentally ill people are having to be discharged from hospital to make way, and you know, there isn't there's no funding to kind of give them proper care in the community, and so for me, those are the things that I try and kind of, when I feel a bit powerless in my platform as a journalist and a, you know, a writer, and I try and sort of work, you know, sort of bang the drum about that, because you know, I'm very privileged white middle-class woman, 40, in a house with a, you know, and I have resources and I have, you know, a system set up, and but there are, you know, so many people out there who don't, and it's all, you know, and it's all well and good for me to kind of bang on about how it's okay for me, but you know, I am in an incredibly privileged position, and I know that it's not okay for a lot of people right now.
Yeah,
you know, and and the system is just so kind of stacked against people with mental health issues.
Yeah.
And, you know, that really needs to be changed. And I think, and my worry is that the pandemic sets that back. People that work in mental health services in
are
the
amazing.
NHS and in the third sector are amazing, and they work, you know, so hard. So this isn't, it's not a criticism of them, and it's not a criticism of that, but it's a criticism of the government's lack of funding for it, and the sort of lack of, you know, they don't, it's not that they, I'm sure they do, you know, I'm sure they don't purposely not care, it's just that it doesn't kind of fall into their radar,
but
they have access to private healthcare. For them, it's not an issue, but most people don't have access to private healthcare. Mm-hmm. And the Tory government, you know, like, you know, they were the ones that had it written into the NHS constitution that mental health would have parity with physical health.
Yeah.
So it's like a legal requirement. But I think this pandemic is also, it kind of, it's woken up, it's opened our eyes to how the health system has been failed, you know, over the last few years.
Big and time,
You hope that that will kind of, you know, kick, you know, maybe there will be some good that comes out of it. I don't know.
But, yeah.
You know, we can but hope. The other thing to know is that you can self-refer. iAPT, if you have a GP, so you can just do it online. But the thing is, my great belief is that we all need to know what, because hearing endlessly about how bad mental health provision is in the country is in itself not helpful if you were in crisis, right?
That's true.
You think there's nothing. What we need to do is, like, make it in the same way that it's kind of instinctive what we would do if we broke an arm, or, you know, our child had a fever for 3 days in a row. You know, we'd go to the doctor, we'd go to A&E. We need to make it instinctive that people
that that's
know
what you do.
What to do with mental illness and what is available, because there is stuff available. So iAPT, for example, is there in England, and, you know, and then there's, you know, there's different levels of care depending on the level of severity of your mental health issue. But also, there are all sorts of guidelines in place as to how long you should be waiting for.
Yeah.
And if we know what those guidelines are,
we can stick
and I
can
off the top of my head tell you what it is for iAPT services, but you should really be seen or referred within sort of 6 weeks or something. But you can, you know, then you have the power and the knowledge to go to your doctor and say, well, this hasn't happened.
Yeah.
They could chase it. And the more that people on the ground are feeding back to doctors and letting this be known, and sort of what one would, I guess, kicking up a perfectly reasonable fucking fuss about it, the more that the government know, are told but they need to sort their shit out.
Yeah.
And give more money. So for me, it's about... it is about sort of informing people of what's available, because that's if we have it written into our sort of DNA in the same way that it is with physical health, then it becomes much easier for us to hold the government accountable for what they're not providing but should be providing. So I've done this whole chapter in my new book about how to, where to go for help.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah.
And spent ages talking to, like, you know, people working in the NHS and their advice on how to, you know, how to go into a GP, and, you know, but how to, what to do, you know, if you're having to deal with CAMHS, which is child and young adult mental health services. And, you know, there's all sorts of stuff out there, but it is a bit of a minefield. And because the only narrative we hear is how bad provision is, people kind of just go, well, there can't be any. And then they, you know, I think it's really important that we let people know, you know, and also, you know, why is it that IAPT is available in England, but not in Scotland, Wales or Northern Ireland? And you can self-refer in England, but you can't, you know, like, these are, I mean, that's
weird.
That's a whole, another political conversation entirely, but, you know, and I, there are, for example, things that during the first lockdown, the NHS in England, not, you worked tirelessly to get mental health crisis lines. So every area now in the country has one.
Amazing.
But people don't necessarily know about them, and I think that's really important, is like just the information, because, you know, we hear so much about how talking about your mental health is important. Well, it is, but it's the first step, and it's the first step that leads you to other things. It's the route, you know, it's how someone is on the road to recovery, but it isn't the recovery.
I think one thing that has been great about, like, the one of the great outcomes of having all my therapy online was the fact that I have my therapist's email address, which you don't normally get through the, in the NHS, you don't normally have any contact with them other than in your session. And he said, when we finished, he was like, if you ever want to just chat, then you've got my email, you can send me emails.
That's really nice.
You can, so I have the contact with the same person rather than having to start again and again every time. And I think it's really nice to know that I, like, even if I never use it, I know I have the option to contact this person who's gone through, you know, 12 weeks of therapy with me.
And also, I feel that, like, actually the online services, the fact that a lot of it is online should, you know, in many cases should actually improve waiting time.
Said it's cut them down massively.
There is a lot that needs to be done, and but people are, you know, starting to do it. And I think it is important to say to people that there is help out there for OCD. And also, I think just that little bit of knowledge, which I think that we need to, is that most mental illnesses are a brain misfire. Trying to help or trying to protect us. You know, there's a fantastic book which I would urge everyone to read called This Book Will Change Your Mind About Mental Health by a man called Nathan Filer. And it's sort of, it's about schizophrenia, but it's but schizophrenia is quite an unhelpful term in that it it covers so many different. But it's a fantastic book about, you know, he talks about how, about the sort of the wiring of why. So, for example, the most well known features of schizophrenia are delusions, paranoid delusions, and delusions of grandeur. And he talks about some. There's a theory about, when you go right way back to the African plains, when humans first, you know, evolved, what did we have to do? We had to look over our shoulders to check there wasn't another tribe or, you know, a lion coming to get us. Paranoid delusions. And what would we do if we came across that tribe or that lion? We would make ourselves big.
Oh my God, that makes so much sense.
And so there's this really, and that to me was like one of the most helpful pieces
that
of information.
Most
revolutionary in terms of seeing how my mental health, because we hear all this stuff about, you know, people try and liken physical to mental health in some ways which are quite unhelpful. So they'll say things like, well, it's just a chemical imbalance, but that's not quite true. Do you know what I mean? Like, of course, it is that your you know, there will be moments where hormones are low or have lower levels, but it is, but the way, seeing it like that in our brain, it's a fantastically complex organ and one of the only organs that you cannot transplant. And it is, so it's that, it's a kind of very, most of these mental illnesses are sort of like misfirings of the brain. Primitive, you know, it's why you hear a lot about anxiety and fight and flight. You can take it on for all sorts of things. And that to me was allowed me to put everything in context.
Yeah, and that's a bit of a game changer,
I suppose.
Do you mind me asking about, so you spoke about the coping strategies that you've used. I just wondered which, obviously you said like kind of alcohol and drugs and things were ones that didn't
recommend.
That you wouldn't recommend. And then also I know, like, what are the things that you think have really helped in coping?
So I actually, weirdly, my treatment for alcoholism, it was kind of a revelatory, even my brain can't speak, in terms of my OCD, because it helped me to understand and unpick what was going on. So I still see my counsellor from there, and he, you know, he's really helped me to put that in perspective. But also, you know, exercise, movement, getting outside, sleep. It's all the really boring stuff, I'm afraid. People always come to me and they're like, should I try like mindfulness and meditation? And I'm like, let's fuck off mindfulness and meditation. Asking someone in crisis, mental health crisis, to do mindfulness and meditation is like asking someone in a lead suit to go for a swim. It's just not useful.
So true.
They're great tools when you've got yourself back to a place in the equilibrium to keep you there, but they are not, you know, they are, for someone at the first stages of seeking recovery, you've got to take it back to the basics, right?
Yeah.
Like, are you sleeping? Now, of course, it's complicated because often the first thing that goes when you're stressed or you're anxious is your sleep. You know, are you trying to get sleep? Are you eating 3 meals a day? Right, and not junk. Do you know what I mean? Because that has a huge. Are you drinking lots of water? Are you drinking alcohol? Well, cut that shit out. Do you know what I mean? Like, and I know. Listen, you're talking to an alcoholic here. I know how difficult that can be. You know, coffee, caffeine, fizzy. You know, all that shit. Like, it does all have a massive effect. Get outside, go for a walk. Like, it doesn't. And the point is, it's all those little things. Those little things help you to get to a. To feel like you have a sense of agency over what's going on as well.
Yeah.
So that's my advice. You know, those are the basics. But also, I find thinking of my OCD or any kind of my mental health issues as Jareth.
Yeah.
And knowing that it's almost like Invasion of the Body Snatchers, right? And knowing that my Jareth or my inner alien or whatever you want to call it does not want me to get well. So it can tell me things in this voice that is indistinguishable from my own. So it makes me think that it's my psyche, my inner self that wants it. So like, oh, just stay in bed. Don't get out of bed. Go outside. You know, and sometimes we do need to stay in bed all day. Like, I don't get me wrong. I've had that, but but then what'll happen is your Jareth will go, oh, you piece of shit. Stay in bed all day. You're so lazy. Right. No, fuck off. I did it because
wanted
that's
to.
Me. I'm a human. Do you know what I mean? So it's like you talk to yourself in a way, you know, you have to, it's almost like you have to learn to do the opposite of what you want to do. So I often know if my brain wants me to do something, I shouldn't do it. And if it doesn't want me to do something, I should do it.
Yeah, I know, you're so right.
I think those are the kind of helpful tips that and just connecting with people. And, you know, and looking into what services there are in your area. But for me, those have been the key things.
I think running, I love the way you speak about running in your books, but also on the podcast I first heard you on, Happy Place, because I think you spoke about, there was something you said that I have held on to a little bit, which was about how when you were training, or maybe you were doing the marathon, and you said something like, when it gets really, really tough and you hit that runner's wall, like you're just like, yeah, but this is nothing compared to my worst days in mental health. And that was really, well, that's quite motivational when you're running, because you're like, Remember that. Keep going.
I remember the first marathon I did, getting to mile 21 and being like, is there ever going to be a time when I'm not running this marathon? Right? And being like, and then going, shut up, Bryony. Come on. You've had days where you've literally, not been able to leave the house, not been able to even draw the curtains.
Yeah, because you think you're this evil human.
This is why. And people are shouting your name and handing you Haribo. Like, get on with it.
Yeah, and it's just like that feeling when you're in your worst, when you're in the fog of an OCD moment, like, it honestly, it does feel like you would rather anything but that.
Yeah.
When you're in that situation, you would rather be on mile 21. I'd rather be on mile 21 and thinking I'm about to pass out. Like,
I do think running is, you know, for me, exercise growing up was always about punishing yourself, and it was about the losses and not the gains. And for me, running, exercising for my head rather than, and my heart rather than for the way it makes me look, has completely revolutionized the way. Like, I don't do it to be the fastest or the strongest. I do it to be happy.
Yeah.
That's the only reason I do it. I get up and do it. And, you know, if I'm running for 25 minutes, whatever, like, that's 25 minutes when I'm not focusing purely on fighting Jareth. And, you know, on you know, if we're going to talk about chemical imbalances and all that jazz, do you know what I mean? Like, on a chemical level, your body does kick in and start to release endorphins. So you do, you know, it's just like, and instead of, and there you go, you know, like, no one ever wants to go for a run. Do you know what I mean? Like, don't get me wrong, I never want to go for a run, but I've never regretted going for one.
So true.
Ever.
Yeah.
So I just remind myself of that. In fact, this morning I was supposed to go for a run and I actually didn't. And, you know, but that's fine. That's
I
fine.
Haven't either. Yeah. You know, it's fine. Yeah. I was also meant to.
I mean, I'm still in my pyjamas, if we're honest. So.
I'm very jealous.
We were just going to ask about medication and your experiences with medication. And
I mean, I'm on medication still. I you know, I take fluoxetine. I don't come off medication now because I've been on it for so long. It would be, I don't have a year to just go through the horrors of coming off antidepressants. And so my feeling about it is that, this is the best way for me to sum it up, okay? Like, take antidepressants, you know, like, if you are off them, take antidepressants, but don't let that be the only thing you do.
No.
So, like, taking antidepressants and then expecting that to do all the work is like an athlete, an injured athlete, taking ibuprofen, but then doing no physio.
Yeah.
Right? For the injury. And, like, you know, I think that they are... You know, there are some people, don't get me wrong, there are some people that do need medication for the, you know, brain chemistry issues. So I'm not, this isn't, but I do think they are overprescribed.
Yeah.
And I understand why they're overprescribed. And they're overprescribed because they're such bad provision.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Like, so it's complicated, do you know what I mean? Mm. And I used to be like, oh, I'd take a pill for a cold. Why don't I take a pill for depression? But it is a bit, you know, I can now see that it's sort of complicated, and I think that, you know, listen, my life is not impacted by, to be honest, I don't know how much antidepressants do for me, do you know what I mean? Like, I don't know, I've ever lived without them,
no,
I do know what happens when if I forget to take a dose one day. It's not pretty, right?
Yeah.
And so all I would say is that they are not the be-all and end-all, do you know what I mean? And they are helpful for lots of people, some people they're not for them, and it's up to you.
Yeah.
But I would say is that whatever you do, don't see them as the magic bullet. And I, like, although I have to say that when I was really unwell and when I was 17 and I first took them, I remember just the act of taking them made me feel like I was doing something positive.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's all sorts of research out there about it, but they're nothing to be ashamed of.
No.
Because look, I mean, like, I'm bloody hell. Like,
yeah.
I'm just, you know, they're just, it's, for me, it's like I take, like, I have a little, like, diet, like a little shot thing I do in the morning, not like alcohol, obviously, like, turmeric thing.
Oh, yeah.
And then I just take my, you know, it doesn't bother me. It just literally doesn't impact my life.
Yeah.
But coming off them would.
Yes. So, exactly. Yeah.
So I just stick with them.
Yeah.
Really.
Well, I have the thing of, I was put on medication when I was 11 or 12. I literally have no idea what I'm like without them. I just don't know.
And that was because you were at such a point of crisis, really, like, because Susanna lost a lot of weight because of her OCD, because it was about not eating in order to then
not be sick. So it was like, it was, and I was dropping out of school and all this kind of, so they, I think they just kind of
had
thought,
to, really.
Yeah, I've got to get something going. So they put me on that. I started on sertraline and I'm now on fluoxetine. But so the only period I've ever had not being on them is that
a child
that slight changeover where I came off sertraline to go on to fluoxetine, and other than that I don't, like, obviously during that time everything's weird anyway because you're coming off an antidepressant and then going on to one, so everything's kind of,
yeah, I think that lots of people come off antidepressants and then assume that the way they're feeling is because that's how they're going to feel, and actually it's withdrawal.
Whatever
I would say is do not
cold turkey
these things without doctor approval.
Just don't do it.
And remember that when you're switching, or if you're upping, even if you're upping your dose or you're lowering your dose, that has an effect on the way you feel as well. So you know, but the bottom line is I take them, but they're not the only thing I do.
Yeah.
And I probably only still take them. The only reason I take them is because I don't want to come off them and have to experience them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you find OCD really difficult to deal with in terms of relationships? Has it affected you with kind of like when you were dating people, or not just romantic relationships, like in other relationships? Has it tried to get involved in that sense, part of your life, or has it managed to not?
No, of course it has. When I was pregnant, I've written about that extensively. I just became convinced that the baby wasn't my husband's, I blanked something out. Yeah, no, of course it does. I mean, it impacts every area of my life. But yeah, I didn't really have any meaningful relationships before I met my husband, which is a bit sad. But no, I mean, there was all sorts of other chaos going on there. And I always say that OCD kind of it impacted me in so many ways because of the booze and the drugs. And it's hard to know what was what and what was causing what.
Yeah.
Something we've been asking everyone that we've interviewed was, if you had a magic wand, and you could just wave it and get rid of OCD.
Like you never had it.
Yeah. Would you? Would you do that? Or would you? Yeah.
No, because I wouldn't be talking to you two, would I?
Yeah.
Listen, the times when I've been in an OCD episode, yes, I would wave that magic wand. But, you know, I am the person I am. And I don't want to wave any magic wands over my life, however awful bits of it have been. You know, fundamentally, my life is now... really, you know, there are difficult bits in it and they're hard, but it's really good. I've learned so much through my OCD. You know, I have learned about how to be mentally well through being mentally ill. And I think I have strengths. I think a lot of us have strengths that, you know, others might not have if they haven't experienced that sort of crisis. So, you know, I think Stephen Fry says it, you know, in his Desert Island Discs, he talks about the angel on one shoulder and the devil, all sorts of things in my life have, you know, I am who I am, so I don't want to change any element of that, you know, like the sensitive, the care, you know, the bit of me in my brain that thinks I'm so scared, I feel so unsafe, but I need to do something to protect me, makes me want to kind of hold me, not kind of go, forget that, you know, that's, yeah. I don't know if that makes any
I love
sense,
that answer. But... No, I think that's like a perfect answer. And interestingly, it's what every single guest
has said. Yeah.
Which is really interesting so far, I think.
Yeah.
I am aware, though, if someone's listening in crisis right now, you won't feel that way.
No.
And I know that because I haven't felt that way. But what I will tell you is that if you hold on and if you talk to people and keep talking about the, you know, the dark things in your head, you will get through it.
Thanks so much for listening. Please do check out OCD Action and OCD UK for support. We've linked both in our show notes below.
As always, you can find us on Twitter at RepeatPod1 and Instagram at OnRepeatPodcast. You can also email us your stories and feedback on repeatpod@gmail.com. Huge shout out to Patrick Ryan for creating our logo and the fabulous Jack Wharton for composing our theme tune.